The case was like a Shakespearean mashup. Young lovers from different worlds, thwarting their families, secret assignations, jealousy, suspicion, and honor besmirched. The villain, not a Moor exactly, but a Muslim all the same. And a final act of murderous revenge. In the main stage, a regular old high school across the street from a 7-Eleven.
The podcast Serial digs into the case of a Baltimore teenager murdered in 1999. We'll talk about the listener frenzy around Serial in just a bit. But first, President Obama is in Beijing at the APEC Summit of Pacific Rim Leaders, where he announced a new policy between the U.S. and China.
During my visit, the United States and China have agreed to implement a new arrangement for visas that will benefit everyone from students to tourists to businesses large and small. Under the current arrangement, visas between our two countries last for only 1 year. Under the new arrangement, student and exchange visas will be extended to 5 years. Business and tourist visas will be extended to 10 years.
Here to tell us more about the new visa policy is Jeff Wasserstrom. He's a professor of modern Chinese history at UC Irvine and author of the book China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome.
Great to be on.
All right. So what do we need to know about this new visa deal?
Well, I think it's one of the rare instances of something that China and the United States can agree on. There really is a win-win deal for both sides because there are lots of things creating tension between the two countries, but both presidents clearly feel that having more people and more money flowing across the Pacific in both directions is something that will benefit us. And it certainly will ease a lot of the problems that are faced by ordinary people involved in this flow across the borders, especially students who can have a visa that will last for their whole period of study, which just makes enormous sense.
Right. It certainly makes enormous sense for Chinese students coming here, and there are quite a few of them. I'm sure you have a lot of Chinese students in your classes, or you see them on your campus?
Enormous numbers. It's something that has changed exponentially in the 25 years I've been teaching at various places. And in California, it's very, very clear at Irvine.
Right. And so do you think that is going to pose a problem here in California? Because there has been some pushback to that, where California-born students say that Chinese students or students from other places are taking up spots reserved for them that should go to them.
Well, there are issues that come up with that, and there are other issues that come up that frustrate faculty. One problem is, in China, there's been widespread scandals with cheating on SATs and buying scores. And so some students from China come over woefully unprepared. Not all of them. There are some very, very good students. But that, I think, is a large issue going forward to try to work on as well.
I understand the Chinese president's daughter is studying at Harvard.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. A lot of people think about the decline of America, but in certain ways, our reputation in China, certainly for higher education, remains very, very strong. Harvard's the most highly regarded brand name in China, even higher than Oxford and Cambridge, though those are respected too.
So that's the student part of it. The business part of it, extending the one-year visa to 10 years, that seems to me, on the face of it, to possibly have a huge impact in terms of investment in the United States from Chinese businesses.
Yeah, it's a huge impact in investment in the United States. And it's also important to realize that in terms of business people from here going over to China, that there have been a variety of things that have made it less attractive to be living in some Chinese city recently. We've heard a lot about the horrific smog. There's also a lot of criticism of foreign influence in China in the press now, a kind of paranoid strain in the Chinese government. So you have a moment where it's getting less and less appealing to be an American doing business and or working for a company in China. So anything that's a step in a kind of positive direction is going to be important and feel good right now.
So what are some of the negatives? What are some of the issues that the two countries have to deal with? And maybe they're not going to be talking about publicly, but might be having private conversations, the two leaders?
Well, there are just enormous issues in the sense that the United States is quite committed to maintaining an important presence of support in the Pacific, on the other side of the Pacific. And China is really determined to reclaim the status that it had for millennia and then lost during this very traumatic century of being clearly the dominant country in the East Asian region. And so this leads to all kinds of tension with us having alliances with Japan, and the tension between China and Japan over disputed islands. And just in general, there are all kinds of just very basic disagreements, including Obama can't say anything very dramatic about Hong Kong. But clearly, when there are students on the streets in Hong Kong calling for a full say in real open elections, this is something that Beijing does not want to see happen. They don't want the students to be on the street, and they certainly don't want to give up controlling who gets appointed to run Hong Kong as chief executive. And when it comes to American values, clearly there's more that resonates about what the students are doing than what Beijing is doing. So there are all kinds of issues right down the line. And the biggest issue going forward for the world is for Obama and Xi to find a way for the two countries to work together on climate change. And that would be the kind of, if there were some meaningful agreement on that, that would, of course, be much, much bigger and better news for all of us.
And is that something President Obama is pushing for?
There have been efforts to try to get there, but I don't see any signs that would be the thing to hope for. But it would be so much more complicated. In part, there's a fundamental disagreement over whether China should be cut more slack because it's still a developing country, and that the onus should be on the developed world to move first. The U.S. is still the biggest carbon consumer in terms of per capita. China is the biggest overall. So it depends which of these kinds of numbers you focus on who has to take the lead and responsibility. But clearly, for the world's sake, the two sides have to find some way to deal with this.
Jeff Wasserstrom, author of the book China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, also a professor of modern Chinese history at UC Irvine. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
With changes to visa rules, we'll probably see more Chinese people living here in Southern California over the next few years. But it seems that Chinese money has already arrived in a big way, especially in downtown Los Angeles. Last year, the Chinese invested $750 million in L.A. real estate, and they've doubled the amount they've poured in over the last 5 years. Eddie Kim has been following the story for the L.A. Downtown News, and he's here now. Welcome.
Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. Why so much Chinese money showing up right now, especially in downtown?
Well, I think you have to look at first what's happening in the mainland China. There's a glut of capital in the Chinese development market, and the real big players want to diversify their assets. So we're seeing investments not just in downtown, not just in L.A., but in New York City, in Seattle, in Canada, Australia. The list really goes on. And I think the special thing about downtown is L.A. has the advantage of being a gateway city, but having developable land in the heart of it. So there aren't too many major cities with 4, 5, 6 acre sites in the heart of the metropolis. And that gives, in downtown, the Chinese the ability to build their own trophy projects rather than buy existing ones or invest in smaller ones.
And that's something different, you point out, than with, let's say, the Japanese when they were investing heavily in the 1980s, when they were just mainly investing in already existing infrastructure.
Right, and it was mostly office towers. And what I've been told is it's different because of the mentality. You know, when the yen was booming, the investments were about buying up a whole lot of assets, just throwing money around and hanging on to them for the future. The risk analysis, I'm told, was not nearly as good as it is today. And because Japanese investors weren't building their own projects or improving on the assets that they bought, there was really little value left once the yen bubble burst. The Chinese, on the other hand, are way more wary. Experts say they've been eyeing this downtown and LA market for years, and they're going into this with a real desire to get a return on investment as soon as possible. So they're building what appear to be some very quality projects with the hope of filling them with local tenants and residents just as much as just having the asset itself.
Okay, talk about a few of them. You mentioned one in your article. One is a $1 billion 6-acre project.
Right. So that's Greenland Group's Metropolis project. And the crazy thing about that is it's been stagnant for 27 years, this site. It's been entitled. It was permitted for a long time, and there were multiple development attempts. So this is a $1 billion project now. There are 4 towers, a 19-story hotel, and 3 huge condo towers, and a big podium full of retail shops.
And where is that? Where is that? Metropolis?
Oh, that is just north of the LA Live complex, right in the middle of downtown.
Okay.
Right across the street, just east of Staples Center, is Oceanwide Real Estate's Big Central site, as it's dubbed. Again, that's been stagnant for a long time. A New York group was trying to develop it for years. And what their plans show today is three towers with hotel and residential and a massive retail podium on the ground floor as well. And then a third key one is smaller, but Shenzhen Hazen's real estate group bought the Lux City Center Hotel, again, across the street from LA Live. And they could spend upwards of $350 million to rebuild the hotel and also build residential or office towers on attached land.
And are there any restrictions on foreign investment?
No. You know, I've been told that it's tricky sometimes just because of LA's notoriously complex permitting and planning system. But really, the city's trying to encourage as much foreign development as possible because, you know, local and even national developers weren't getting it done. These sites were bought, and now they're breaking ground. The turnaround's been quick, and that's really good news for the local area.
And so what are people saying? Maybe it's too soon for a reaction, but what are people saying about these new visa rules that will give business people 10-year-long visas if they want them?
Well, I think it's kind of hard to say how that's going to end up. I think right now there is an emphasis on, for LA as well, to try and get as many diverse international partners as possible. So I think especially the business community sees this as a good thing because it gives them more people to work with, more money to work with. Whether that's going to impact local businesses and local groups, it may, but it's hard to say at this point, I think.
And it's not just downtown office and hotel complexes and apartment buildings, I guess, but it's also real estate throughout Los Angeles that Chinese investors are interested in, right?
Yes. Two great areas of interest is the San Gabriel Valley, which has traditionally been a great place for Chinese people to come here and settle with families, as well as Orange County. Now, the big thing is we may be seeing sort of the middle to the end of the big, giant projects in downtown just because it is running out of land. So Chinese developers, again, want to build big projects. So they may go out into the suburbs where there is more potential to build planned communities that are very, very large and require a lot of investment and get a lot of return.
What about in the existing residential real estate market?
That is a little tricky, too, because I think a lot of Chinese individuals have certainly been buying houses en masse for years, especially in San Gabriel. In downtown, because there is a new development boom, I think the temptation is to either build or partner into new projects rather than invest in existing ones.
Okay, so with all this building and investment, does it mean that a lot more Chinese people will move here, will immigrate here, and put their stamp on the region culturally?
Well, yes and maybe no. It's again, hard to say, but what we're seeing is sort of a cultural and social shift. Tourism from China has quadrupled in LA from 2009. There were 570,000 visitors just last year. More Chinese nationals are sending their kids to school here, and Chinese investment into the county in general has doubled over the past 5 years. So, you know, I think it is very safe to say that we will see more Chinese immigrants coming here to set up businesses and set up families. But these projects aren't for them necessarily. It's also for people who are already here because they're seeing a local boom in especially the residential market.
Let's talk about Hollywood. And director and producer Brett Ratner was quoted in The Hollywood Reporter saying that China was going to be the saving grace of the movie business. What does that look like?
Well, for years now, China has been trying to attract more of Hollywood's business. And I think Hollywood itself has been trying to diversify and have more productions in China. So that's been ongoing. And, you know, there's been lots of news about how many theaters, for instance, are being built in China. But what's really interesting is China's trying to put a stake right here. I think one big development project to mention is Wanda Group, another juggernaut from China, just dropped in August $1.2 billion on a site in Beverly Hills to serve as their U.S. base for a budding movie and TV production business that's headquartered in China right now. And they're using that as kind of the place to start local investments into film productions and to really branch out and be a part of Hollywood. That's a huge move, and that's something different that we haven't seen. But definitely it's a back and forth because China is very attractive because of lower production costs for U.S. companies and because of some tax subsidies that they're offering as well.
Eddie Kim, reporter for the LA Downtown News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up, The Obsession That Is Serial, a new weekly podcast that tries to solve a murder and answer the question, is the guy who was convicted guilty? But are we guilty of being entertained by real-life trauma? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
This is a Global CalLink prepaid call from
Adnan Sayed,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility.
If you're among the 1 million people listening to the new podcast, Serial, you probably recognize its opening theme. Serial follows host Sarah Koenig as she reinvestigates the murder of Haemin Lee, a high school student in Baltimore. She was killed in 1999. Lee's ex-boyfriend, Adnan Sayed, is in prison for the crime, but the question remains, did he do it? It's not an uncommon story, someone convicted of a crime he may not have committed. But there's something new and compelling in Serial's story. So compelling that it's iTunes' number one podcast, and it's inspired a subreddit group of amateur detectives who are trying to solve the crime, too. Serial is also the topic of another podcast about it, and that's put out by Slate. It's called Serial Spoiler Special. Katie Waldman writes for Slate and is a commentator on that podcast, and she's here now. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And why did Slate start this podcast?
Well, it was funny. After the first podcast aired, we communicate with each other with this IM instant message system called Slack. And we had to create our own Slate Slack channel in order to hash out our theories and talk about what had happened on Serial. And there was just so much interest that we decided, wow, these conversations are probably unfolding in all kinds of offices and coffee shops, and people seem to have this kind of infinite appetite for Serial. So let's capitalize on that and create a podcast to analyze the phenomenon in the show.
Right. And so why do you think it is a phenomenon? Certainly there have been stories of murders, true crime, of people possibly wrongly committed, told before. Why is this one so compelling?
Well, I think there are a few things. The first is that the podcast format makes this really an experiment. This hasn't been done before on podcasts. And there's this intimacy that you have when you're listening to other people's voices. And we get that with the hosts of podcasts. But here, not only do we have it with Sarah, but we have it with these characters in a really gripping mystery story. And I think that there's a way in which hearing Adnan's voice, hearing the voices of the people involved in the case, brings it home to us that these are real people and makes it incredibly captivating.
Okay, let's hear a clip of tape from Sarah Koenig talking about the difficulty in investigating an old case like this one.
I see many problems with the state's case, but then I see many problems with Adnan's story, too. And so I start to doubt him. Then I talk to him and talk to him and talk to him, and I start to doubt my doubts. And then I worry that I'm a sucker, then I don't know. That's the cycle.
So I guess also what's compelling is hearing her work out her own reporting.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of a classic detective story, and Sarah is really a character in it. She's the detective, and I know that we sort of go back and forth on the Spoiler Special podcast about what role Sarah should be playing, and is it uncomfortable to have her sort of soul search about how she feels about Adnan instead of just giving us the facts, ma'am. But I really enjoy having her as this ambivalent guide through all the facts of the case.
You know, I was reading a piece on this in The Atlantic earlier, and the person who wrote it posed this question that I think is sort of at the heart of it. Are Serial listeners in it for examining the issues surrounding the criminal justice system, or are we just trawling through, I'm quoting here, a grieving family's pain as a form of entertainment?
I think that is really a difficult question and kind of at the heart of both Serial's appeal and that kind of discomfort that maybe some people feel. I know sometimes I feel listening to it because it is a real story and we're treating it as though it were a narrative written by a master writer. And I think you even see it when people are wondering, well, how much does Sarah know? What will we find out at the end? As if the ending were dictated by some kind of authorial intent, as opposed to what facts have surfaced. And you can't argue with those facts. So, yeah, I do think it's an interesting and possibly problematic ethical position that Serial's in. And I'm not quite sure how to navigate that as a listener.
Right. Because often true crime isn't summed up in a tidy narrative and doesn't have the drama, the story arc that an Agatha Christie has, for example.
Exactly.
So meanwhile, there's this other Reddit discussion happening where people are not just talking about the podcast, but actually talking about the crime and trying to chase down their own leads.
I have dipped my toe in the roiling Reddit waters, and it's intense. There's a lot of information. I mean, the experience of listening to Serial is being flooded with details and timelines and call records, and then you just go into Reddit, and it's orders of magnitude more than that, and it can be pretty overwhelming. And, you know, they do a good job, the moderators, making people corroborate their identities in some way, but it's still hard to trust everything that shows up on Reddit. I know that they're at least a few episodes ahead of the actual podcast in terms of what they know. You know, they've released images from high school yearbooks, and they've gotten people from the high school out of the woodwork to say certain things about Adnan's character. So it's definitely, there's a lot more for people who need to scratch that itch in between episodes.
I guess let's just get down to the story itself and talk about it. What do you think about it? And do you think Adnan did it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I am so confused. I am trying to be like Deirdre in the latest episode, who says that you juggle and then you freeze and let everything just kind of float in the air above you. And you don't allow a narrative to coalesce, even though I so badly want one particular answer to emerge as the one that seems obvious. But no, I have no idea. I think there may be some conspiracy. I think Adnan was probably involved. I'm not sure if he actually killed Hay. And I'm also, I feel like the show sort of has two main issues. The first is the mystery, whodunit, and that's mm-hmm. fascinating. But there's also the secondary mystery of, or question of, will Adnan be exonerated? Even if we don't find the answer to the crime, can he get out of prison? Because it seems like there's so much reasonable doubt. And I do remain hopeful that even if Sarah can't find the platonic form of the answer in this case, there will be enough reasonable doubt to get Adnan out of jail.
Wow. Okay, I guess stay tuned is what we have to say then.
Right?
Katie Waldman, staff writer for Slate and a commentator on Slate's podcast. It's called The Serial Spoiler Special. Serial drops once a week on Thursday mornings on iTunes, and The Serial Spoiler Special comes out just a few short hours after that. All right. Do you have a podcast that you're obsessed with? Will your friends not shut up about Serial? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, a mass murderer, Heinrich Himmler, the architect of the final solution. Diary entries and letters to his wife and daughter capture his unvarnished thoughts as he sent millions of people to their deaths. That's after this news update from Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The ordinary life of a man who committed unspeakable acts is captured in the new documentary, The Decent One. It's about Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS and architect of the Holocaust. A freshly discovered trove of letters and journal entries and photographs by Himmler and his wife provide the basis for the film and provide a window into what Himmler was thinking as he carried out the final solution.
Wir werden niemals roh und herzlos sein, wo es nicht sein muss, das ist klar.
Israeli director Vanessa Lapa is in town this week for a couple of screenings, and she's here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
How did you get these documents, and how did you get the photographs?
The documents were for 40 years under the bed of an Israeli man named Chaim Rosenthal. In 2006, his son convinced him that it's time to get rid of it and do something important with it. So his son spoke with a professor at the Tel Aviv University who knew me. It took me about a month and a half to hesitate whether, you know, to dive into it or not. But obviously I decided to pick up the challenge, and here we are 7 years later.
7 years later. How did he happen to have these documents?
We will never know exactly. There is a gap between 1945, when the American soldiers took them from the house of Himmler in Germany, and 1960, when he got them. Either it's a flea market in Los Angeles, or flea market in Brussels, or through a couple that was crossing the American-Mexican border, and he got it from them. As to how they got from Gmund to Rosenthal in 1960.
Wow.
Rosenthal passed away in 2012, and he died with the secret.
And he just kept them in his house.
Obsessively kept it under his bed. On the one hand, unable to do anything with it. On the other hand, afraid that they would land in the wrong hands. I mean, I understand that it's something haunting. For the first thing I did was to put the collection in a safe deposit box. And the last months of the post-production, when we needed the original for shooting and for graphics, you know, it was horrible to sleep with them at home because the safe deposit box closes at 4 in the afternoon. So we were working, obviously, after 4, so we didn't have every day the time to bring it back to the safe deposit box and in the morning to pick it up. So it was in our apartment for a few nights in a row, and it is haunting.
But what were you afraid of, that people would steal them? Or
No, I should have been, but I'm not. It's uncomfortable, you know, to have a huge private collection of diaries. You know, I'm uncomfortable to read the personal diaries or letters of someone else. But in the case of Himmler, it's even more uncomfortable, you know, to have all his private writings in your apartment.
You just felt creepy. It was creepy surrounded by his private thoughts.
Yeah, it is creepy.
How many of them were there?
The collection contains about 350 letters from him to his wife, about 15 different diaries, the childhood diaries that he and his wife wrote about their daughter, the diary of the daughter, the diary of the wife, the household expenses, the Christmas log, and then about 135 still pictures and postcards and school reports.
Wow. And all in German?
The main part of the collection is written in Old German.
That's really interesting that it was written, the early things were written in Old German, because he talks about his longing for an old Germany, a Germany of the past, and bringing it back. And of course, that was part of the ideology of the Nazis.
Exactly. And the reason why in 43 the Nazis switched the old German to the modern German we know today is because Hitler heard or decided that old German is a Jewish invention. So in 43 he decided, starting now, we switch to modern German, the German we know today.
So when you started going through these letters and these journal entries, what did you think? What was surprising to you?
It was very uncomfortable. The moment that, you know, I managed to overcome the uncomfortability of reading Himmler private writings, what became disturbing until the end was time and time again to realize how normal, how ordinary he is, and to get hit or surprised again at the end of the letter, no matter whether it is about work or if it is to his wife, the perversity, the twist, everything that is seemingly normal, he manages to twist. He loves his wife, they're going to get married, so he loves her the most in the world, but there may be something that he will love more than her, and this is the fatherland, the nation. So, you know, this is really subtext, but it's his perverse character is to me, we don't have a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It is the same person.
You hired actors to read the letters, and so you hear his voice, or what you imagine his voice to be, as he's reading or speaking to his wife.
Ich fuhr auf Besuch zu Hugo. Seine kleine Tochter Irmgard hüpfte vor dem ins Bett genackt umeinander. Ich finde, dass im Alter von 3 Jahren, wo man dem Kind Schamhaftigkeit...
He doesn't really talk about his work that much with her, or with his daughter, whom he expresses a lot of love for, and she, to him, she seemed very devoted to him. Did the family, did they not have a full idea of what he was doing and what his job was?
It's a question I'm asking myself very often. By now, I think that what is more important is why they didn't ask, why his wife didn't ask. I mean, his daughter was 12 to 16 years old. You know, she knew, apparently she knew that there was war, but I don't know up to what extent she can know at the age. But what is frightening is that his wife didn't ask enough questions, and she being a reflection of everyone and the whole world at this period. It's not only a film about them, and it's not only a film about the Second World War. It's a film about human beings and moments where politicians make choices and economical situations and leaders like Hitler that are in a certain place at a certain moment and with a certain choice, very fast, all hell break loose. And to me, it's what is very relevant today as well.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Vanessa Lapa. She's the director of a new documentary called The Decent One. And it's about Heinrich Himmler and his really about his relationship with his family and his wife, even though he doesn't spend much time with them. So there's this obsessive letter sending, and he numbers each letter. An obsessive record keeping of what he did. And in 1945, when the war is lost for the Nazis and he's captured, he commits suicide. He takes a cyanide pill. Do you think a lot was lost not hearing what he had to say, not having him testify at the Nuremberg trials? Or do you think that looking at these documents that you have, you've captured a full sense of who he was and what he was thinking?
The content of the collection is very revealing, although there is nothing inside that is changing the face of history, which probably cannot be changed because this is what it was. It's because no matter what Himmler would have testified or would have said to the world, it would have been planned. He would have been recorded. The amazing thing about the content of the collection is that it was written not in the aim to be published. Unlike the Goebbels diaries, for example, when Goebbels wrote his diaries, he was the minister of propaganda. He knew they would be, or he hoped they would be published one day. In this collection, it was not meant to be published, so very often boring, but everything that one can learn, especially psychologists and academics, is very helpful for research and for the psychological understanding of evil and of a mind that is able to do this.
He was, as most historians point out, probably the number two man under Hitler. And he honestly didn't think that his letters and his journals wouldn't be made public in some way or wouldn't be the basis for some kind of published work.
It was supposed to be burned. It was kept in his, he kept it in his house. It was not the official records. And he asked one of his secretaries to come to the house and burn it. But it was the end of the war, and the Americans got to the house before the secretary. He was already running, trying to escape, and his wife and daughter were trying to escape, so no one was at the house. So he just didn't make it on time to burn it.
What happened to his wife and daughter?
They were captured and interrogated.
Germany, 26th of September, 1945. Do you swear the testimony which you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Ja, ich schwöre, dass alles, was ich sage, die reine Wahrheit ist.
What is your full name?
Margarete Himmler.
And what was your husband's name?
Heinrich Himmler.
The interrogation is very a protocol interrogation because she was the wife of Heinrich Himmler, so they asked us her protocol questions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem from the transcript of the interrogation that the soldiers hoped to have answers through her. They just interrogated her because they had to. Most of the questions were rhetoric questions. They already knew the answers. A lot of questions about their daily life, why she didn't ask, did she know? They asked her if he had other children with another woman.
Which so, he did.
Which he did, yes. But it's obvious that the soldiers who asked the questions knew that he did. They were not expecting to have from Marga any historical or criminal insight that they didn't know. And after the interrogation, they were released. I mean, Marga was the wife of, she didn't do anything wrong legally, in a legal way of speaking.
And his daughter, Gudrun, is she still alive?
Gudrun is still alive. She's 85. She's a convicted Nazi. She's supporting an organization who is supporting financially and psychologically convicted war criminals. I tried to meet with her for the last 7 years. I wanted to give her a diary back in order to have an interview. Then I offered her diary just for her talking to a camera. Then I offered her diary just to meet with me and talk to me off the record. But she didn't want to. She never gave an interview. She would prefer to do anything than to go public.
We've heard ever since Hannah Arendt coined the phrase, the banality of evil, that this was something that took place at all reaches of German society, that there was this passive acquiescence in some cases to this. And just by reading these diary entries and these letters, did you have a more visceral understanding of that, of what is known as the banality of evil?
Definitely, yes. But in the opposite way, I strongly believe that there is nothing banal in the evil. I also believe that there is a big difference between the evil of Eichmann that Hannah Arendt is referring to and the evil of Himmler. Eichmann was a yes man. Himmler was leading, had ideas. He masterminded the final solution. He took decisions. There is nothing in my eyes banal in the evil of Himmler.
But I guess the question is, why him? Why did he make those choices? And it's maybe impossible to answer that.
I think that this is, it's why, you know, there is no answer, I think, or no absolute answer to this question.
Well, Vanessa Lapa, thank you for coming in today.
I thank you.
That's Vanessa Lapa. She's the director of the documentary The Decent One, and she'll present her movie and do a Q&A this Thursday night at 7:30 at the Lemley Theater in Encino. And sitting in for Warren Olney this Veterans Day, Barbara Bogave, welcome. Nice to see you again.
Lovely to see you, Madeline. So we're talking today about, we're really giving you a snapshot of vets and the jobs outlook, their jobs outlook. And like everything with the jobs reports, the numbers are, there are many ways to read them. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of subtleties. And one issue with vets who have a 2% higher rate of unemployment than the general population is that there's very, very specific population within vets, post-9/11 war vets and younger vets and women, female veterans, who are having the most trouble.
Is there a stigma on the part of employers?
Absolutely. And it's interesting. It's a conflict between, are they heroes? Are they damaged? They're both, in perhaps in recruiters, employers' eyes.
Right. Oh, fascinating. Okay. Look forward to that at 1 o'clock. To the Point with Barbara Bogave. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
And coming up on this program, when is mayo not mayo? A lawsuit says a vegan spread cannot call itself mayonnaise. How Silicon Valley billionaires are involved. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A new lawsuit is set to rock the very foundation of the condiment world, mayonnaise. Is it the same thing as mayo? And if mayo doesn't contain eggs, can you still call it mayo? Does it still taste delicious on fries, more importantly? Unilever is the maker of Hellmann's mayonnaise and Best Foods, and they would say no to all but the last one on that list. Unilever is suing the makers of Just Mayo, a spread that replaces eggs with peas. Alan Bjerga covers food and agriculture for Bloomberg. Welcome back, Alan.
Hi.
Well, how is it that Unilever can sue over something like this? Because, you know, you can't sue penguins for being birds that don't fly, for example.
Well, there's an interesting point here to be made in terms of trademark and definition protection. I mean, what Hellmann's is ultimately talking about here is his branding, and it really creates a bit of a condiment conundrum. You have a case where Hampton Creek is calling their product Just Mayo. Unilever has 60% of market share with Hellmann's and Best Foods, and they want to protect what they see as the holy name of mayonnaise, which, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, indeed includes vegetable oils and eggs. We see this a lot in terms of the food world over the last decade or so. You know, consumers still want to have the products that they want to have with the dietary guidelines that they want to follow. And so there's been a lot of interest in an eggless mayonnaise. Finally, after a lot of funding from groups including the Gates Foundation, Just Mayo seems to be making a go of it. And here comes Hellmann saying, wait, you can't call this mayonnaise. You can't even call it mayo. You're clearly infringing on our good name. And what they are really sharing here is a new form of competition.
Right. So what they're really worried about is that Just Mayo is eating into their profits?
Well, it is eating into their profits. You've seen a really fast adaption from this company. You know, this food company has only existed for 3 years, and already you're seeing them on the shelves of Walmart and Costco. You know, this is more than just the organic food sector. This is really going mainstream. How much of a threat there is, Hellmann's isn't even saying in their lawsuit. But this is also something you see in a lot of cases with companies. You know, well, again, looking at the type of what a brand is. You know, Coca-Cola, Starbucks, large companies end up having to play the heavy in situations like these because, again, even if they let this one go, now they're afraid that Miracle Whip is going to come around and come up with their eggless mayonnaise product. And before you know it, what they see as a key component of their brand identity has been diluted.
Well, I guess they could create their own version.
They could. And in fact, there are some court documents saying that they were trying this very thing several years ago. It would have been interesting to see if Hellmann's had come up with an eggless product, what they would have called it. This is certainly a potential growth market. Unilever is always interested in growth. Of all of their major sectors of their brands in the last year, food is the only one that really isn't growing. And this is a way to sort of play a defensive action. And maybe hope that they can come up with a strategy of their own.
So the USDA has these strict definitions for certain foods, but it appears that this definition is pretty old, decades old. Should they be updating their definitions?
Yes. This is a Food and Drug Administration definition that dates to 1957, and certainly a lot of things have changed since then. I mean, we certainly had never heard of gluten-free pasta at that point in time. And it just points out that a lot of these regulations and rules don't necessarily reflect the great variety and, great, frankly, the great innovation you have seen in product lines over the last few decades, both with the natural foods movement and, frankly, in some of the unnatural foods that you've seen created. There's a real need to look at a lot of this stuff.
Right. So I also read today that mayonnaise is America's most popular condiment. So that surprised me. I thought it might be ketchup or salsa.
Yeah, it does show you just how important this thing is and why Unilever would care so much about Hellmann's being called mayonnaise and something else taking a different name. I mean, I'm a native Midwesterner. We tend to eat a lot of Miracle Whip up there. And even then, you know that Miracle Whip, even though when I was growing up, a lot of times when people said mayonnaise, they were referring to Miracle Whip. You take a look at the label on it, it's called salad dressing. Miracle Whip doesn't go by mayonnaise. Unilever is thinking that just mayo really isn't mayonnaise either, so they should just call it something else.
Well, they also, I understand, are taking issue with the picture of the label, I guess, on the cover of the jar. There's an image of an egg, and it's being pierced, I guess, by a pea shoot.
Something by like a that. Yellow pea, which indeed is the replacement for eggs in Just Mayo. And maybe this is a case where, and of course we can't read the minds of Unilever, but it could be a case of adding some insult to injury. Part of Unilever's case is saying this is part of the strategy by Just Mayo, not just to say they're an alternative, but they are superior. And the implication on the label that somehow these yellow peas are superior to the eggs that have fed generations of people of America's most famous condiment and most used, you know, that probably sticks in the craw of some of the folks at Unilever, and it's certainly not, you know, creating good feeling for the folks in the large agriculture milieu that it represents.
Yeah, except that Hampton Creek is backed by billionaires Bill Gates and Tom Steyer and is a bit of a darling of the Silicon Valley world. And so it seems that they can't really paint themselves as the little guy in this, can they?
That's true. That's true. You know, there's an easy media narrative you can follow in these as sort of the David versus Goliath. And you'll see it in some of the coverage of it, where it's sort of the little company that could against the company that has a market capitalization value of $117 billion a year. You're absolutely right. Just Mayo has made some quick inroads. They have some serious backers, and those backers are looking for those alternatives. That, in the end, might be what is making Unilever nervous.
And why is Silicon Valley involved in food?
You know, this kind of goes back to when the Gates Foundation, about a decade ago, was looking at its charitable products and thinking they've been focusing a lot on developing world health care. But they really realized that you can't create healthier people unless people are well fed. And so when you look at some of the sustainability issues, some of the environmental issues that tend to be causes for Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who get interested in the world beyond technology, food and sustainability become sort of a natural outgrowth of what you see from folks like Steyer's efforts, from Bill Gates' efforts. They're getting more and more involved in this. And as you alluded to, they have capital. And if they can launch a product like this, they certainly can launch others.
Have you tried it, Just Mayo?
You know, I haven't. I haven't been eating a lot of mayonnaise or condiments particularly much at all because the calorie counts are high and I've been spending most of my time home with my newborn. We haven't been eating a lot of that lately.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Alan Bjerga covers food and agriculture for Bloomberg, author of the book Endless Appetites, How the Commodities Casino Creates Hunger and Unrest. Congratulations on the newborn, by the way, Alan.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Julie Myers, would you like to try Just Mayo? It sounds kind of tasty.
I'm not super huge on any kind of globby condiment.
Gelatinous. Mystery condiment.
I'd be willing to try it, though. I'm one of those people where you put it in front of me and I go, yeah, I'll give it a try. So, yeah, I would try it, especially if there are French fries involved.
Yes.
That is
key,
delicious.
Key ingredient.
It's key. You know, I underestimated our listeners' passion for mayonnaise. It's astonishing.
As we said, it's the number one condiment.
Apparently. In my household, it's more like sriracha is covering everything. But there were so many comments on Facebook, and it was a contentious debate. Let's start with William Sharp. He says he thinks it's great that there are vegan alternatives to mayonnaise, but the food should be labeled as such. He says he'd be pretty peeved if he ended up buying Just Mayo, got it home, and realized it wasn't actually mayonnaise. Which actually happened to Justin Gutierrez. He said he picked up a jar of Just Mayo thinking that it was mayonnaise, and it was not very tasty. he says euphemistically. But Paul Silver points out that the label of just mayo doesn't say anything about mayonnaise. Just says mayo. Unilever has no case against them. Snickers McFlurry says that it seems Unilever is afraid of competition and wants to crush a scrappy startup. He's rooting for just mayo. Charlene Lefebvre says no to mayonnaise and no to vegan mayonnaise. The only way to consume it is if you make it yourself. Whip up some egg yolk, oil, mustard, yum. Randy Clemens says that Unilever's managed to get Just Mayo a ton of free advertising by suing them. Way to go, Unilever.
That is so true.
It's true. The comments go on and on. Kevin Stevenson says he's got a new product for us. It's called Just Sugar, but it doesn't contain any sugar. He says, see, I can do it too. And Robert Lawson says that mayonnaise is an abomination, no matter the form. So I think that we're going to give Robert Lawson the last word here.
Who knew that mayonnaise would excite so many of our listeners?
Pretty incredible. You guys should check it out on Facebook.
Okay, our Facebook page is KCRW Press Play, and we also have voicemail if you want to leave a voicemail. 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Julie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney coming up at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.